Hello, and welcome to this podcast version of Forsaken Chains, a crime detective novel of fiction presented to you in part, chapter by chapter. This podcast may contain mature themes, and discretion is advised. For more information, or to order your copy of the novel, send an email to forsakenchains@gmail.com. I am your host, Ronald Proshott, and you are listening to Forsaken Chains, read aloud by Margaret Jones Bricker. Now, here's Forsaken Chains by Ruth Langner.
Another 3 weeks passed, and Clarissa had heard nothing from the police department handling the matter of her son's disappearance. She knew the trip to London would be exhausting, and cringed at the thought of speaking with Miss P. Eberhardt again, but she couldn't bear the silence any longer. At 9:30 on the morning of November 29th, 1983, a troubled Clarissa left Hensley Hall Cottage to return to London, to the massive building swarming with detectives, holding on to a flicker of hope that some good news would come of her trek. She had entered the frail, elderly population group with grace, and carried herself proudly with the assurance of a queen, a refined beauty, coiffed and perfect in her presentation. Her unwavering need for primness was one trait inherited from her mother. Admirably dressed, today she chose a sensible, soft, burgundy crepe dress, draped with an effortlessly elegant baby alpaca ankle-grazing coat, with a small diamond brooch on the inverted pleat. On her head she wore a purple wool hat adorned with a dark silk flower, from which protruded a single ostrich feather, a touch she found quietly amusing. In her right hand she carried her elegant walking cane. By 10:30 she passed through the doors of the granite building housing Scotland Yard and felt the sensation of having entered the belly of a giant blue whale. All around her were men and women in their navy uniforms, their hushed conversations echoing back from the high walls of the arched lobby. Clarissa made her way along the corridors and halls back to the uninviting Bureau of Missing Persons. For all their crime detection techniques, their electronic gadgets, cutting-edge technology capable of monitoring movements of the masses, and their ability to thwart worldwide terror plots, Clarissa was amazed they couldn't find a friendlier employee for such a sensitive position. The very same Miss P. Eberhardt, with the disposition of an overfed mule, stepped up to the counter. It was clear she held a tight rein on her post, asserting her independent decision-making power over which reports would move forward and to whom they would be assigned. She sifted through some papers and made light of Andrew's absence when she spoke. "People go missing all the time," she said. "He is an adult. He has a legal right to disappear. If we opened a file whenever a mother became concerned about her son, well, your son may have his own reasons for disappearing." Her neck retracted slightly, exposing a thick vein that ran down one side and disappeared into her chest. "Just what in heaven's name is she insinuating?" Clarissa was alive to the patronizing tone in the clerk's voice. The few questions the clerk chose to answer were reluctantly, almost resentfully disclosed. Clarissa would have none of it. Going to a higher command seemed a reasonable approach. She renewed her pressure with a stern and robust voice. "I shall have an interview with Superintendent Whittaker," whose name she drew from frequent quotes in the London Times and The Guardian. A much celebrated character such as Whittaker had a reputation to lose. He appeared so often in print that the articles read like a television miniseries. Broadcasters across the country uttered his name in reverence as they reported the news. Millions of people read the Times to follow the work of Detective Chief Superintendent Whittaker, to read his brilliant reporting of how he had found another culprit. His portfolio contained hundreds of award-winning criminals whose confessions had led them to reflect on their actions while serving a long period in Her Majesty's service. By reputation, she knew very well that Whittaker reveled in his accomplishments, such that the people of London were not soon to forget the happenings under their delicate noses. "DCS Whittaker is not in this department, madam," retorted the clerk. "I am quite aware of that." Clarissa's cheeks reddened. "It might do well to remind you I am a woman of some resources and influence." With that, she tossed her head slightly and glared steadfastly at the arrogant clerk behind the counter, giving her cane a solid stomp. She retreated to the corridor, letting the door bang soundly behind her, and tapped her way over to the building directory mounted on the wall in the lobby near the elevator. She scanned the listings and discovered DCS Whittaker's office was on the fourth floor. When she arrived, the young woman behind the desk eyed her carefully. "Do you have an appointment?"
"I do not."
"Detective Chief Superintendent Whittaker is a very busy man, Mrs. Spencer Thornton. What is the nature of your business with the super?"
"Superintendent Whittaker will know me by name. It is significant. I am sure he will understand what that means."
"I'll announce you when he is next available. In the meanwhile, please have a seat, Mrs. Spencer Thornton." Clarissa concluded that the level of respect and professionalism improved incrementally each floor of the building, and was grateful that the Missing Persons Bureau was not in the cellar. The minutes ticked by, and Clarissa sat steadfastly in her chair, letting off not one inkling that she was impatient. 30 minutes passed, and a door opened. Two men appeared and began shaking hands heartily. Members of the clerical staff looked up as Whittaker strode past their desks, escorting the other gentleman to the door. He returned, greeting his staff by name.
"Good day, sir."
His personal assistant followed closely behind him, rattling off several names of pending appointments and urgent messages. As she entered his office, she lowered her voice.
"Mrs. Clarissa Spencer Thornton has dropped by to see you, sir. She doesn't have an appointment."
"Who?"
"Mrs. Spencer Thornton. She said you would recognize the name."
Whittaker shook his head.
"In what context do you suppose I should know this woman?"
"She has filed a missing person report on her son, Andrew Thornton, a reputable lawyer. She claims they've done nothing in missing persons. Sir, the family has peerage."
The final statement struck the needed accord. His mind jogged back to the time when he first encountered Mrs. Thornton and remembered the occasion, an art and antiques fundraising event where everyone had swanned about in their finest and paid excessive prices for merchandise they didn't need or even want. He had attended the function as a patron, and she had been inducted as an honorary member for distinguished contributions to the arts.
"Ah, yes, of course."
Whittaker received Clarissa with his best demeanor, pulling up a chair and allowing her hand to be placed on his arm as he guided her forward.
"I want you to find my son, Superintendent."
She started in a soft voice.
"He has been missing for 42 days. I asked to speak with you directly."
She glanced at the gold embossed plaque to be sure she used the correct title.
"To
Detective Chief Superintendent Whittaker. I find my experience with the Bureau of Missing Persons very unsatisfactory. If you'll pardon me for saying, but I find they have been extremely delinquent in the commencement of proper inquiries into my son's disappearance." Whittaker's steely blue eyes gave Madame Thornton a quick glance over and waited to assess whether she would break down in tears. Instead, she continued delivering mechanically controlled phrases. "I had the grave and unfortunate experience of reporting my son missing on November 3rd. It is now November 29th, 3 weeks since filing my report. 3 weeks is an awfully long time for a file to languish, Mr. Whittaker." Her head shook slightly, waving the ostrich feather on her hat. "Have you any idea what it is like for a mother not knowing what has happened to her son? That wretched department has not taken this matter seriously. I pressed them for information with scant details forthcoming." "Is that not precisely what the Missing Persons Bureau is supposed to do? Am I not to conclude their job is to find missing people?" Whittaker raised his eyebrows and furrowed his brow at her assessment. "There are many things that could have happened." "My son would never have committed suicide. Never!" She insisted when that possibility and other diverse theories was presented to her. "As I explained to Miss P. Eberhardt, it is most unusual for my son not to contact me. I believe that despite the indications my son went abroad, it may not be so." She spoke of Andrew with enormous pride, choking back tears. She painted Andrew as having spotless manners, a gifted ear for music, and exalted talents in his profession as a lawyer. He had not an enemy in the world. "What devoted mother would not say these things," Whittaker muttered beneath his breath. "To Mrs. Thornton, I'm sure your son conducts himself impeccably. Any personal relationships I should know of?" "No." "Has he a spouse?" "No." "Children?" "I just told you my son is not married." Whittaker paused. Seemingly, Mrs. Spencer Thornton lived in an age before premarital sex was acceptable conduct. 48, handsome, intelligent, rich, and never been married. He fantasized briefly over various motives of delicacy, speculating on exciting transactions that might have positively affected Thornton's pocketbook. Perhaps he made thundering profits as a philanthropist, a sophisticated opportunist, or managed conveyancing transactions for a prominent Saudi industrialist. Such stories, if they could be proved, would be brilliant fodder for the public. Clarissa reached into her handbag, pulled out an envelope, and gently slid out its contents onto the chief super's desk. She carefully selected two pieces of paper and placed them in front of the curious Whittaker, who had begun stroking the hair of his moustache. "I am meant to be deceived," she began. Her voice quivered at a nervous pitch. "Before you are two letters." Pointing to the paper on the left, she explained. "This one Andrew wrote to me when he was holidaying in Italy last year." She shifted her finger to the paper on her right. "The other arrived 2 days ago." Whittaker scanned his eyes over the two letters and pointed to the one on his left. "Is this your son's handwriting?"
"It is not."
"You are certain?"
"I am certain. Andrew did not write that letter."
She pointed out the inconsistencies in the letters, the grammatically flawed structure, incorrect use of punctuation, mixed verb tense, and other errors.
Andrew was fastidious in his writing. He would not write in such bad form, she concluded definitively.
Whittaker held the paper up to the light and examined it closely, fingering it, looking for watermarks.
Looks like the paper is a run-of-the-mill bond, but I'm not a paper analyst. We'll have the crest identified, but likely it will be a type found in any stationery shop. We have experts who can analyze the handwriting and the ink if need be.
He busied himself with the papers, holding both letters up to the light again.
If your son didn't write this letter, then whoever did had knowledge of and access to his particular paper stock, for both letters use the same paper. May I see the envelope?
She handed him the envelope that accompanied the second letter. It was the typical light blue with red and blue chevron stripes decorating the edges, and the words airmail sandwiched in between. The postmark was unfortunately so smudged that the naked eye could not discern its origin or date of departure.
You do not know my son, Mr. Whittaker. He would have somehow got word to me, but this did not come from him.
Do you have any clue as to who might go to such lengths to disguise his whereabouts?
Her eyes dropped slightly as she shook her head.
I do not.
Whittaker sensed her agitation could not be controlled much longer. Though she was not one to be mollycoddled, her slender hands trembled as she placed them on the arms of the chair to steady herself as she rose.
Will you now be taking active steps toward finding my son?
With the resources we have, I can assure you, Mrs. Spencer Thornton, our efforts will be directed at finding your son.
A look of annoyance spread across his face. It had been over 30 days since her son disappeared, and protocol dictated that the file should have been transferred up by now. At length he said,
I will put my best man on it. You have my word. And since we do not have any concrete evidence to go on, well, I am content that Missing Persons Bureau was doing the best it could.
Whittaker picked up the letters and placed them in a departmental envelope. Our forensic section will examine the letters thoroughly, and if we come up with any relevant information, we will let you know. But for now, that's all we can do.
That is precisely what they told me downstairs, and I heard nothing. I shall expect to hear from you shortly.
It was her feminine quality that compelled her to have the last word. Were it not that Andrew Thornton descended from the Spencer nobility, little more would have come from the complaint. Whittaker put aside his lunch and summoned the file. It had been 42 days, as Mrs. Spencer Thornton so eloquently pointed out, and MPB had not performed even so much as preliminary inquiries. This was appalling. It was obvious something was amiss. He was resentful and somewhat embarrassed to be confronted with the failures of police to follow basic procedures. His finger jammed violently on the buzzer that connected him to his clerk.
Send in D.I. McCauley.
Detective Inspector Frank McCauley appeared shortly after receiving the summons.
Sir,
I want to talk to you about a missing person by the name of Andrew Ronald Thornton. Have you heard the name before?
Can't say that I have. What's up?
Whittaker handed him a folder. This file was assigned to a low-ranking constable at MPB in the form of a missing person report, filed by the mother, Spencer Thornton, a family name of some distinction. Mrs. Spencer Thornton's father, Sir Edmund Raleigh Spencer, was Attorney General of Sri Lanka, Ceylon, back in the day.
came back to England with a fortune made from prudent investments in tea, I'm told, and bought a large estate in the village of Chert. Her son has gone missing. When it involves the elite, well, we can't be too vigilant. It was commonly understood the words underlying this last phrase uttered by the legendary Whittaker actually meant he wanted to be in the spotlight of any crime involving the rich or famous. Whenever there was a high-profile crime, it seemed the detective chief superintendent took the podium in front of an audience mixed with journalists, constables, and others who came to hear his elixir of facts. The great Whittaker of Scotland Yard was in his prime, always having his fingers in every upper-crust London pie. When it came to briefings, he was a man besotted with the sound of his own voice. Twice divorced, he was a slim, fit man in his late 50s, with hair as meticulously trimmed as the gardens at Blenheim Palace. He presented well, and women fawned over him when he appeared in public. Though brilliant in his field, he liked women who stroked his ego, but unfortunately, they also drained his bank account. We are judged by our results, not how many cases we have on our desk. In any event, the constable over in MPB let the file fall impotently into the abyss, and now Madam Spencer Thornton is on my doorstep. I'm turning this file over to you. Find Andrew Thornton. Macaulay raised his eyebrows slightly as he flipped through the file handed to him by Whittaker. I don't disagree with the initial assessment the officer gave the file. He figured our chap's likely going to turn up. Truthfully, the Missing Persons Bureau is overwhelmed with reports. Other departments are constantly poaching their investigators, leaving them strapped for resources. When the report came to the junior officer, he probably scanned the particulars and, on the risk chart, considered the matter low-ranking, classifying the subject as absent. Better to use their time finding a 14-year-old girl before she's found in the dustbin. Overall, they triage and carry on. When one of society's elite disappears, you do not simply toss it off and assign the subject as absent. Thornton is not someone likely to be involved in the sex trade, illicit drugs, or one who has a history of going missing. The logical sequence of events would be at minimum to interview the reportee, witnesses who last saw him, family, friends, and work colleagues, and conduct a search of his home and office. They did nothing. Whittaker's imagination and speculation rose. Initially, I considered kidnapping. There would be a sizable chunk of money to be got. Why else would a wealthy, prestigious London lawyer be kidnapped, if not for his money? A disgruntled client who feels fleeced by exorbitant legal fees, perhaps? Macaulay looked up at Whittaker and shrugged. Why would a kidnapper keep his captive for so long without issuing a demand? Risk of getting caught grows with every day. That is puzzling, of course, and why I ultimately dismissed the theory. I appreciate these posh toffs shouldn't get special treatment, but I'll wager Mrs. Spencer Thornton will not hesitate to let the world know the department messed up. Whittaker chewed off the end of his cigar and spat it into the wastebasket. The circumstances are suspicious. It would appear Thornton's lack of communication is unusual, and his normal life patterns have an unexplained interruption. Given the length of time elapsed since Thornton was last seen, I'm convinced we need to treat this investigation as a homicide. For the privacy of the family, I want this to be a covert investigation, cleared up as quickly as possible. No press until I am fully informed. Arrange with Madam Thornton to let us search her son's flat. Go over to Thornton's office and poke around. Follow the trail of breadcrumbs. There are at least 15 lawyers who may have something to say. Well, lawyers generally do.
With that shopping list, Whittaker delegated the unpleasant task of handling Mrs. Spencer Thornton and of finding Andrew Thornton to his detective. Apparently, the Spencer Thornton name and reputation held such sway that no one cast the slightest shadow of doubt as to their moral superiority, though Macaulay sensed Whittaker was exaggerating the degree to which Mrs. Thornton tore apart the department. He knew instinctively when the file was fobbed off onto him. The reasoning behind Whittaker's interest in the case meant he suspected there was more intrigue than a simple disappearance. It's the only explanation why Whittaker would be interested in this file, other than Thornton's status. Macaulay had been working in the Department of Serious Crime Investigation for several years and prided himself on his abilities, had a keen admiration for his own talents, and was not one to concede defeat. His record showed modestly fair investigative work and accomplishments in solving crime. Leastwise, he felt he had demonstrated his capabilities rather well. It was useless to argue that chasing down a missing person was not his preferred area of policing. There were many subordinates aptly capable of the work, but if Whittaker's instincts proved correct, the mystery could become interesting.
If you would like to make a comment, you can do so right here in this website, or send an email to forsakenchains@gmail.com. The author is looking forward to hearing from you. This recording was made possible by the facilities of Arts North Digital Studio and Media in partnership with the Community Arts Council. Music for this podcast is taken from D. Maldow, composed by Bedrick Smetna and performed by the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Come back soon for the next episode of this suspenseful novel and find out more with Detective Macaulay of the Serious Crime Unit, Metropolitan Police, London, UK. I sure hope you have enjoyed this chapter. Thanks for listening.